Stay with us. We've got the first guest this morning on the Local News Hour is the Wasatch County School District Academic Advisor coming on to talk about what their plans are for opening in later in August. In the meantime, Summit County Sheriff deputies responded to an accident in Oakley where a driver stopped to avoid hitting a child on a bike, but then struck another youngster. The incident report said the accident occurred Wednesday night, the 15th, on Rodeo Circle in Oakley. The deputies determined that two children on bicycles failed to stop at a stop sign. The driver, a 51-year-old Oakley man, said he braked for the first child. He kept his eyes on that youngster, but when he began to slowly move forward, he felt his car hit something and realized it was a second bicycle. The injured 6-year-old child was not wearing a helmet and was struck by the front bumper of the car. The youngster was taken to the Park City Medical Center in stable condition and was later taken to a Salt Lake hospital with a skull fracture. The driver was not issued a citation.
This is Mark with ESCO Heating, AC, Plumbing, and Electrical, supporting KPCW. With this warm weather, we can perform air conditioning inspections and tune-ups. More info at 855-ESCO-NOW or escoutah.com. That's ESCO, ESCO.
Park City Police are seeking information leading to those responsible for the vandalism of the Black Lives Matter mural on Main Street. Rick Bruff has more.
A statement from police said that the case of criminal mischief occurred on Main in the early morning hours of Wednesday, July 8th. The suspect or suspects used a large quantity of gray paint to blot over the mural, which was sanctioned by the city, quote, to celebrate and showcase social equity over the July 4th weekend, unquote. The department says that some vague video surveillance may be showing persons of interest in the area at the time. Anyone with information is encouraged to call the department's tip line at 615-5555 or go online at parkcity.org/departments/police/contact-us. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
In response to the increase in COVID-19 cases, the Intermountain Heber Valley Instacare is offering on-site curbside COVID-19 testing for the Wasatch County residents. If you meet criteria, you'll be tested for COVID-19. A physician's order is not required and is available to everyone. To find out if you need testing, call the COVID-19 hotline at 844-442-5224 or use the new Symptom Tracker app at intermountainhealthcare.org. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization supporting KPCW.
Well, despite most of Summit County's fair events having been canceled, artists are still able to submit their work for the virtual Summit County Fair art exhibit. Park City Summit County Arts is now accepting submissions for the online Summit County Fair Fine Arts exhibit. The annual Summit County Fair Fine Arts Show will look a little different this year due to the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic. Summit County residents can submit artwork for the virtual exhibit by filling out the fair application form available at pcarts.org under experience and emailing a high-resolution JPG or PNG to admin@pcarts.org. This needs to be done by July 31st. And then also happening here in town, there is, Connect Summit County offering mental health resources. Difficult time right now, people feeling isolated. Connect Summit County offers these mental health resources at connectsummitcounty.org LF in crisis. If you are experiencing suicidal thoughts or struggling with your mental health, please contact the Summit County crisis number 833-995-1295 or download the Safe UT app. It's monitored 24 hours a day by clinicians who respond to all chats, texts, and calls. If you are in immediate danger, call 911 or go to the closest ER. Thanks for listening to KPCW. It is 8:14, and our first guest for the Local News Hour is on the line. Wasatch School District Academic Director Garrick Peterson is here to talk about back-to-school options for the school district in the Wasatch back there. Good morning. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So the governor's office is requiring that all school districts submit a back-to-school plan by the 1st of August. And, of course, so much is in flux, and the cases in Utah continue to spike. It's been a controversial topic on both the national and local level. Garrick, tell us a little bit about how your school district has made its decisions and coming to, coming to the place where you're ready to start looking at opening schools again.
Yeah, all comes to a vote tomorrow night by our school board at 6:30. So all of this that I'm going to talk about today is proposals or options that we're looking at, and then the board will make a decision tomorrow night. But we've done several surveys of our community, tried to figure out what they value and what their concerns are at this time, and that includes parents, faculty, and making sure that we're meeting the needs of people that we have stewardship over. And we noticed three big things came up as we did that. People are very concerned about the academic learning of their students, especially coming off of online school the last 2 months of the school year, which I feel we did well, but it still isn't the same as regular school. The physical well-being of students and staff is a high concern, and then the social and emotional well-being of students and staff. And one of the things we've realized is different people are prioritizing those three things on different levels, and it's guiding their decisions when it comes back to school and what they want, and it could be very different for different people. So as we've moved forward, we've put out surveys also wondering how our community would want school to look. And we've came up with three possible options. And when I say options, at this point, the way it's going forward, this would be a parent choice into these options. And really, there's a fourth as well. But one of the options and the main option is we've surveyed that most of our constituency would like to do is just come back to school full time. So with them coming back full time, we will be able to have regular class schedules, regular bus runs, regular lunch, regular recess, but it will be a health mitigation plan where we'll make sure that we put things in place. We'll help our parents understand and create a culture around when you're sick, stay home. Teachers, when you're sick, stay home. The virus doesn't spread if it doesn't come into school. Increased cleaning protocols, hygiene protocols. When kids walk into a classroom, you sanitize. When they walk out of a classroom, they sanitize. Face coverings will be required. And then we'll have protocols in place for when people show symptoms or school and test positive. So that's our main plan, and it will look fairly normal except for those mitigation factors. Another option that we're giving our parents is to halftime face-to-face. We're calling this a hybrid model, halftime face-to-face, with a focus on math and literacy, and halftime at home, online and supported. So it's still a full-day model, but what this does is it's with the half-day, for instance, in elementary school, let's say our average class size was 26, we do an AM-PM school, they would come for around 3 hours. And they would focus on math and literacy in that face-to-face instruction time. They would not have things like recess or lunch places. But it really puts a priority on the social distancing aspect and staying out of places like lunchrooms and recess areas. And then the parents would be asked to support that from home. And we'd also put modules of science and stuff like that online for our kids to do. And then the third option is full online. We've made some partnerships there to help us with some providers, and that's the third option would be full online. Though there are some, as we've surveyed, there are some parents who also would like to homeschool at this point, and we feel we also have some good resources for them because we want to support them in their efforts. So we'll try to partner with all four groups that have four different needs and give them a little choice coming back. That's the proposal that we're looking at.
Okay, and so any parent can choose any of these options regardless of which grade level they are? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. They will look different in our middle school and high school. We'll, like in the middle school and high school for the half-day option, parents, the kids will come for about They'll come for math, language arts, history, and science class. And then they will do more of their electives online. And so, again, we can get the small class sizes for social distancing purposes. They'll come to their math class one day, and the next day through our streaming service, they'll watch that online. So it looks a little bit different there than the AMPM, but again, the idea is they'll get half-time face-to-face instruction with our teachers, and then they'll do some elective courses online.
Okay, so how will teachers manage all of these different platforms for teaching? I mean, they're working very hard as it is when they're just in the classroom. Yeah. How is that going to work?
That's a great concern and a great question. Our teachers will basically be responsible mostly for option one, and then the half day face to face, but it shouldn't be any more work on them at all because they'll just be instructing, and but half their kids will be in class and half will be at home watching the class online. But it won't be any extra work as far as they'll just be watching the instruction. So it should be a fairly normal setup for our teachers. Not much additional work at all.
Is truancy a bigger issue, a little more complicated and difficult if you're looking at half of the curriculum online? I mean, will they be responsible for those attendance issues and that kind of thing as well?
Yeah, what you do in any online program, you really go into a mindset of any time, any place, and what you really care about is that the kids get the work done. That's the way online school works. And we'll support that. And so we'll really get focused. We're very good in Wasatch School District of defining what it is we want students to learn and creating assessments and assignments that align with those things that we feel are critical to learn. And so we'll just watch those things and make sure that kids are continuing to learn as they go if they choose that option.
Okay. And, you know, this whole mask issue, of course, the governor has let it be up to the county health departments. Well, not let it, but they submit exemptions to, you know, mandating masks. And at this point in time, Wasatch County is not mandating masks. Summit County is. Salt Lake County is. But no other counties in the state are. If you have kids that are wearing masks, I mean, yes, that will help with the spread in the school, but if masks aren't mandated outside of the school, is there a concern that you as educators and people who are in that school every day would have? Because it's a big gathering of human beings all in one place.
Yeah, I think what we stay focused on is what we can control on that one. And that's putting the health mitigation protocols in place for the school. You know, we're just going to encourage that the concept when people are sick, stay home. Please monitor the symptoms at home. We'll monitor our employees coming in daily. We'll monitor parents when they come in. We'll put in our increased cleaning and hygiene protocols and work very closely with the health department when people do test positive for COVID-19. So again, that's what we'll do is we'll stay focused on what we can control and then let those that have stewardship in other areas focus on what their stewardship is.
Okay. And so with those added PPE expenses, how has the school district accommodated that in the budget?
Yeah, so we got some money that came in with, it was kind of part of the round of the stimulus money. It's called CARES money that's helped us to prepare for those kinds of things. It wasn't a large amount, but it was enough to get us up and going and get some things in place. And so for us, it's fairly well in the budget because I think it would have been a bit of a stretch without that CARES money, but that's helped us a bit.
Okay. And will masks be provided at school for children? I mean, are they different sizes and that type of thing? Because elementary age
kids. So what we've
kids.
Done at this point is we've purchased the gator masks for every student. So the gator masks, they will make sure that everyone gets the size that they need. That way everyone will be guaranteed to have a mask. What we're asked is for face covering. So right now there's kind of a big, the face shields are gaining popularity. You can see the kids' faces. Our teachers, we bought teachers' face shields so that our kids can see their faces. It's nice to see a smile and eyes, and that's how we communicate a lot. And as educators, we are communicators, and it's great to see the kids' faces too on that. We ran summer school down here, and so we got a little bit used to what school might feel like coming back in. It was a very positive experience for most kids, and I think that allowed us to figure out some things, especially in our elementary school, where, you know, we had, you know, 10 to 12 kids in a classroom over the summer, and got used to the protocols, and it really went quite well. But I think the shields allowed people to see the face, allows people to see faces better. But masks or shields, but we'll make sure that everyone at least has a gator mask if they want one.
Okay, and will the shields also be provided? There's a little bit more.
At this point, no, the shields won't be provided.
Okay.
We'll see as we move forward.
Okay. And what about teachers who have comorbidity issues, or someone at home who is very vulnerable? What about those teachers who are afraid to come back? Will they be able to hold their jobs, or what's the protocol for that?
I think the greatest resource that we have is our teachers. If our teachers get sick for a couple of weeks, we know that education shuts down. If they have circumstances that are affecting them, that's not good for education either. And so at the top of our list has been the safety of our teachers from the very get-go as we've started to think through this. I think one of the things that we're excited about that half-day option is it does provide a kind of within a classroom of a situation where things are social distance for them, but even in the regular classroom, we feel that things are going to be safe. We've got masks, we've got these mitigation pieces in place, and we think we've done as much as we can. But we still are listening to our teachers, and there are some who have circumstances that are a little bit iffy. And we'll try to accommodate those people to the fullest that we can in coming back to make things as safe as they can, and we'll continue to make that a priority.
So it sounds like it's sort of on an individual basis. You'll deal with each of those as they come along. So are you anticipating a need for more substitutes this year, just with people getting sick?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is, again, with that encouragement of your stay sick, stay home. A lot of times, you know, if you got a little little sniffle or whatever, you put on your work clothes and you go to work. We're going to ask people to be a little bit more careful there. And then, you know, if there's a situation where a teacher has to be out a couple of weeks, we are going to need more subs. So we're thinking through different plans, probably hiring some more permanent subs that are in our system all the time, knowing that we'll need those as we go. But the details of that are still being worked out.
Okay. And then the school board meeting is tomorrow night, and are you expecting a big public turnout?
Well, we're hoping to be able to make that a live meeting. We're not always, you know, most public meetings have been Zoom. I know we were hopeful to make that a live meeting, but I don't think that's been decided 100% yet. If not, it'll be a Zoom meeting, and the information for that can be found on the link on the Wasatch County School District homepage. You never know how many people are going to show up there, but that's a time for people to give their comments.
Yeah. I mean, I've covered a couple of those meetings at the Wasatch School District, and sometimes there's standing room only there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
we'd have to do some kind of protocol to make sure it was not that jam-packed.
Oh, sure. Yeah. but there is, so you did say there's a Zoom meeting, that a link that people can tune into that's on the Wasatch County School District website. Okay.
Yep. And I think what they're doing, we've done several school board meetings since this hit, and usually what people do is just submit their questions or their comments beforehand, or say they want to make one.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Do you have anything else you'd like to say to listeners about just the plans that are in place and what they can expect?
Yeah, I think the big thing is what we want and what we're hoping for is that the first day of school is always one of the most exciting days of a kid's lives, especially if you think of elementary schools. They put on their new clothes, they get ready, the excitement's high, and we really want to get to a point where the excitement in the home is high for the first day of school. The parents are positive, the kids are positive, and that they'll have a good experience coming back, because I think we're ready to give them a great experience. So that's our aim and that's our goal, and we feel like we've come up with a plan that's going to help people to be excited for the first day of school and feel safe.
Sure. Okay. Well, keep us posted. Good luck. We'll probably be following that meeting tomorrow. And thanks so much for coming on, Garrick.
Thanks for having me.
Bye now. That Bye. Is Wasatch School District Academic Director Garrick Peterson. Well, it's 8:30. You're listening to the Local News Hour, and I have Nicole Herway, Clinical Director for the Peace House. She's on the phone to talk about programs that they're offering to help families impacted by abuse, domestic violence, or sexual assault. Thanks for joining us this morning, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
So the Peace House is celebrating 25 years of service for individuals and families who have been the victims of domestic violence. How did the Peace House get started here in Summit County?
It was a large community effort in a response to domestic violence that had occurred in Park City. And so what's amazing is that it was truly a community-supported and facilitated response to first have a home where people could be sheltered who had experienced abuse, domestic violence, or sexual assault. And then through community support and just a lot of movement to support survivors.
Oh, it looks like we've lost our interview with Nicole Herway. Hopefully she'll be back on the line in just a minute. Okay, it looks like we have Nicole. Would you please continue?
Yeah.
25 years?
Yeah, 25 years. So as of last fall, we now have our own building where everything is housed together. So we offer residential housing and soon transitional housing for survivors.
Okay, and so talk about that a little bit, because it used to be that the Peace House was a secret location for the protection of the mm-hmm. victims, and now mm-hmm. it's not a secret any longer. Talk about that philosophy and those changes that occurred.
Yeah, so part of it is public awareness. Sometimes being able to receive services requires some education in order to know where to go and find that. And so our location is publicly disclosed, but our facilities are secure. So we felt that was a good balance between meeting the needs of the awareness for the community while still protecting the safety of our survivors.
Okay. And how is the operation of the shelter impacted by COVID-19 and the spread of that illness?
Yeah, so our shelter is still fully operational. We've just done some precautions to increase social distancing and increased our hygiene and sanitation measures and precautions. And then we've also decided to move our clinical team to telehealth to protect the public health. So our case managers, legal support, and therapists are all using telehealth.
Okay, but there must be some times where you have to have the person come in and be there in person.
Yeah, for protective orders, we do have people come on site, or if people don't have access to technology, we offer technology services so that they can still receive any therapy or case management that they need. And then for those who are in shelter, we have computers and phones that they can use to contact their therapists or case managers.
Okay. And talk a little bit about your clinical program there. This is a new program being offered now?
So it's been around for a long time. We're just making it more robust, if you will, and trying to really meet the needs of the community. So we offer individual, family, and group therapy for all those affected by abuse within their families, domestic violence, or sexual assault. So we've increased the number of therapists and improved the availability for appointments, and also added a bilingual component. So we're trying to really match the needs of the community that we serve.
Okay, and how do people access this? Let's say they're not in the shelter, but they have concerns and that type of thing.
Yeah, so they can call our 24-hour helpline. I think that's the fastest way to get support because you'll immediately be connected to one of our 24/7 advocates. So the phone number there is 1-800-647-9161. And that's the hotline number that you can call and they will schedule an intake appointment. Or they can email me directly. So I'm Nicole Herway, the clinical director, and my email is Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E, at peacehouse, peacehouse.org.
Okay, with families, you know, not all families are working or they're working part-time. People are more, you know, packed into their homes altogether. Schools have been out now since March. People are feeling socially isolated and that type of thing. What have you seen as a result of that? Have there been more incidences of domestic violence?
That's actually a really good question because it's been sort of a catch-22, if you will, meaning the incidences are going up, but it's a really hard time to exit an abusive relationship right now because of the financial insecurity that COVID-19 presents. A lot of survivors are seeing an increase in the abuse, but a decrease in their ability to feel like they have access to resources, which is why we want to put this out there and be more vocal in the community to let them know that there is support out there and that we're a good starting point for that.
Okay. And some of the comments that I've read through these last few months have to do with children who perhaps are victims of abuse because they're not in school. A lot of it's not being identified. Are there other means that you have in place to help identify those things?
Yeah, I think the best thing is going to be family, friends, and neighbors, because without school teachers and those who work in the schools to be able to see it, it really is going to depend on family, friends, and neighbors, which I think is hard sometimes to call our hotline and to ask how to proceed with making a report of abuse to protect the children. So it's, you know, it's a little hard to call on a family member versus someone that you teach at school, but we really are hoping that people will realize that sometimes they're the only voice a child has to report this abuse, and that even though it's hard or awkward or not what you want to do, it still is in the best interest of the child.
Okay. And then I understand that there's a monthly blog that will be published over this next year. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So you mean for all of Peace House or for the clinical program?
Oh, for all of Peace House.
Yeah. So, again, the hope is to kind of let the community be aware of our initiatives that we're taking in Peace House to increase awareness and prevention and education, and also to provide our clinical services, which are case management, legal support, and therapy. So we're just trying to get the community involved and aware and to hopefully decrease the time that it takes someone to seek help from the time of the abuse. So we just want to be out there in the community and be active and increase awareness.
Okay. And then in just having a look at the Peace House narrative, the impacts of abuse can often be delayed and delayed by many years. Many people can feel the effects of it, you know, decades down the road. Are those people also able to access the clinical services you're providing?
Yes, absolutely. So the brain is a fascinating thing because it tries to protect us. So a lot of times what I see with survivors is they've been experiencing abuse for years, sometimes decades. And to them, it seemed normal because the brain needed to protect them and have them think it was normal so that they could survive it. Otherwise, it would just be too overwhelming to bear. And what's really great is, like we said, is the support of family and friends and neighbors and coworkers sometimes to be able to help someone identify what they're experiencing as abuse, to give it that label, is usually the first step towards getting help and healing. And so, we definitely want to encourage family and friends to report where possible so that survivors who sometimes couldn't take that initiative themselves in the first step can also call and get support for those that they love.
Okay. And you offer private clinical services as well as group services. Is that correct?
Yes, and family. And one of the great things about it is that it's anonymous, and it's supported by grant funding and private foundation donations. And so it's free to clients, which allows us to ensure anonymity and then also victim safety. So anyone who comes in, no matter where they're coming from or what their story is, they will receive services free of charge.
Okay. Now, it seems like with, family abuse or domestic violence or abuse, sometimes there's a lot of shame associated with that. How does that work in a group setting? Because there would not really be the ability to be private about your concerns. I mean, how do you decide which should go into a private, clinical setting or which should go into a group and that type of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that we try to provide some psychoeducation around. And so if someone calls into the hotline, we'd kind of talk with them about where they're at in their healing journey to decide what's the best fit for them. So for some people that call in, individual therapy is best. Sometimes family's best, and sometimes group is best. So the current time, most of our groups are more psychoeducation-based, meaning we're providing information about how to recognize abuse, how to set boundaries, how to build resiliency and coping skills. So we don't necessarily dive into what I'd call the deep stuff. It's more information-based, and then in individual or family therapy, that's where we get into kind of the nitty-gritty, if you will.
Okay. And are you doing a lot of this online now that, through Zoom calls and that type of thing, now that the COVID recommendations for distancing are in place?
Yeah, we use a secure telehealth platform, which allows us to be HIPAA and VAWA compliant to protect the anonymity again and provide victim safety. So when people call in through the hotline, their clinician will contact them through a number or an email that they provide, and then it is all through telehealth.
Okay. And how do you charge people for services?
So it's free of charge because we're funded through grant funding and then also through private foundation donations. And so anyone who comes in, you don't have to provide any information. You just have to have a way for us to contact you, and then you get services free of charge.
Okay. Well, great. Anything else you want to say about the new clinical expansion or clinical services expansion?
My only thing I would say is it never hurts to call. So even if you think you might not be a good fit or your family member might not be a good fit, it's always good to call and ask questions. If someone is wanting services, we will have to have the client call the number directly in order to reach out to them. But family members can also call and just ask questions about how they could perhaps help a family member or get support to have that family member then call into the hotline. So
okay.
I would always recommend calling.
Okay. So we'll post that hotline number on our website as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. That is Nicole Herway, Clinical Director with the Peace House, giving us an update on some of the expanded services being offered there. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yes, thank you.
Bye now. Well, it's 8:45, and my next guests, we're still waiting for Doug Clyde to call in from the Summit County Council. And on the phone, however, right now I've got Matt Wagner. He is the Snyderville Basin Trails Manager, and hopefully Doug will join us in just a moment. But thanks, Matt, for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So Basin Recreation and our elected officials from the county have been hearing complaints from residents for a very long time. And there's a lot of frustration for residents who live near trailhead parking areas. They have experienced a range of problems and violations. And at last week's county council meeting, it was decided to install some clearer parking signage at a couple of our very popular busy trailheads in the basin. Can you talk about a little background on that, if you don't mind, Matt?
Sure. So this has been a direct result of some of the public process we've gone through with our partners at the county, including the Future of Trails public forum that happened in June. And as you mentioned, there have certainly been a lot of public comments and public input on trailhead congestion, specifically around what we're hearing a lot about is Rob's Trailhead and trailheads in the Summit Park area, particularly the Parkview area. So it was through this public process, which has been going on for quite a while and dragged on by the COVID restrictions that reduced our ability to have public meetings. We came up with quite a few solutions, and one of them including trying to regulate parking in a more direct way, so that the where people can park and how they can park is just more clearly expressed in signage, and we have more ability to enforce those restrictions. And I think one issue that was raised in the county council meeting when we talked about it was that this trailhead congestion is one of several pieces of this issue. I think the trailhead behavior and violation of county codes relating to burning and dogs off leash and things like that are certainly part of that related issue. And by controlling parking a little bit, I think we are also going to reduce the opportunity for those sorts of trail behavior violations as well.
Okay, so will there be enforcement then of both the parking and then simultaneously some of the off-leash issues and the waste pickup and you know, all of those other things?
Yeah, so the in the short term, we're going to have to rely on our partners at the county again, because Basin Recreation doesn't have the jurisdiction over those public rights of way or some of those parking areas, which are in on county roads. So we have to be empowered with the ability to enforce those county codes, and that's a process that's happening now. The county council should, I think by the end of this month, be hearing some recommendations about how to modify the county's administrative code to allow us to do that. So in the short term, we're relying on the sheriff's department, and they have very generously agreed to patrol some of these areas more often.
Okay.
But we will be, there's also the logistical challenge of us having to increase our capacity to do this enforcement work. So that's going to take some time as well. But hopefully very soon we'll be able to step in and relieve the sheriff's department.
Okay, so there are safety issues around this whole topic because cars, especially like up in Summit Park, they're parking on both sides of the road. It becomes a fire issue, and I guess also pedestrian auto accident potential because you're just so overcrowded. So are the sheriff's deputies already enforcing some of these areas, or has that just not really been a focal point?
Well, there's certainly a presence from the Sheriff's Department at those trailheads, and especially Summit Park, there's a concurrent process going on where we're evaluating the emergency egress routes and trying to parking does not impede the flow of traffic. And so, you know, my impression is that if people are parked in ways that impede the flow of traffic, then they can also be subject to enforcement from the Sheriff's Department. What we're changing now is how parking happens around those trailheads. So clearly defining the areas that are designated for parking around trails. But there's still certainly the sheriff will still enforce parking for if people are parked illegally in the road, blocking the flow of traffic. So kind of separate issues, but we will be empowered more around the trailheads. Basin Recreation will be patrolling those areas.
Okay. Now, if you, say, limit the number of, I guess there are, 18 parking stalls up accessing Rob's Trail. And what happens if the 19th, 20th, or 30th car arrives and they don't have anywhere to park? What will prevent them from just going onto some of those side streets and doing the exact same thing?
So that's something that I think will be part of our public education and outreach campaign. We do have potential for overflow parking, and we have an existing agreement with the Park City Community Church that allows some overflow trail parking down Bear Hollow Drive. And the exception to that, of course, is on Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. There's no trailhead parking there. So I think that's a bit of an education and outreach task for us, in that if people do drive all the way up, that they're going to have to turn around and go back down if parking is full. So and then at that point, if they do choose to park illegally, then that's an enforcement issue, which will involve either our future enforcement official staff or the sheriff's department. So I think it's a combination of education and outreach and the enforcement capacity.
Okay, but if side streets are allowed to park, they're not parked illegally then, correct? I mean, are you planning to sign everything and say there is no parking anywhere in this? I guess I'm trying to understand the education piece. Yes, mm-hmm. It's been discussed for a very long time, but in last week's meeting, I think that the county council members were pretty adamant that it's enough education, it's not working, we need to do something. So what will happen with those cars that go, that overflow, so to speak? Will they be also, ticketed, booted, towed, that type of thing?
I think there's going to be a period of where we're learning how well this works. And right now, I think the distance that we're working with is that if we're restricting parking about a quarter mile from the trailhead on the downhill side, this is at Rob's, and on the uphill side, we're restricting it a little bit farther. But if parking is restricted, what distance is too far for people to then park outside of that zone and then hike or bike up? I think it's going to be an adaptive process. We're certainly, nothing is going to be set in stone initially. But at that point, we will need to reevaluate. We don't want to push usage out further into the neighborhood. That's one of the reasons why this has taken so long, because logistically, if a nearby public right-of-way is not signed, no parking, then it's very easy to drive, another 100 yards down the road, and then you still have access to the trail. So that's been part of the issue, is if you enforce at the trailhead, then you kind of have to enforce everywhere. And so we're going to have to find that middle ground where we certainly, Basin Recreation is not the parking enforcement agency for the county. And so we have to find that middle ground of where we're going to be able to enforce around the trailheads, but we're not necessarily going to have to, we're not going to be able to enforce all county roads.
Sure.
Just because of capacity.
So we've kind of focused our conversation on just these two very popular trailheads. Are there others mm-hmm. that are on the docket that you're going to consider doing similar things with?
I think this is an adaptive or an evaluative process. We're going to implement these parking restrictions in these places. There are certainly other very busy trailheads. I think what's unique about these two, Rob's Trail and Summit Park, is that they are so tightly integrated into the neighborhoods, it's kind of the double-edged sword of their high elevation. They're tucked up into the trees. You can get into the shade very easily. So they're kind of popular for the same reasons, and they're challenging for parking because of the same reasons. So I think that this is going to be our first step. We're certainly up for evaluating parking congestion issues elsewhere. And it's a problem that's not going to go away and certainly not going to be solved by this one implementation or intervention. But, we're committed to making this work. So we're going to pull out every trick we have.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the timing for these signs to go in place now?
So there's some informational sign at Rob's now that went up on Friday afternoon. We're going to work with the Summit County Public Works Department to get the no parking signs put in within the next couple of weeks, and then starting August 1st is when what we're considering sort of our beginning of the enforcement period. And that will be an escalating enforcement where you're ticketed, Then you're booted, then you're towed, and then after a month of that, starting in September, then it's just, if you're outside of the designated parking areas, then the tow truck is just going to be called.
Okay, so you're giving it a month to sort of let people settle in. Now, there's also a lot of speculation that so many people come up from Salt Lake Valley. Has there been further discussion with the council about some type of a fee arrangement to help offsetting the costs, since taxpayers are already paying a lot of money for these trails and the maintenance? But the usage is happening, you know, it's open to everybody. We don't have any system in place to collect any money. How is this, how are you all looking at that?
So one of the ways that we have looked at that is through permitted parking. If people pay at the access point to be able to park at the trailhead, then we might collect some money. But what we found through our research, and I think what a message that needs to be clearly communicated, is that the cost of an enforcement program like that is more than we would collect, just because of the scale of the parking that we have available that we can actually enforce on. It makes it really, really difficult to recover costs, and they're actually kind of two conflicting goals. If we were trying to recover cost, then we would encourage more people to go to trailheads, and we would be creating more parking and trying to charge people for that. But in actuality, we want to kind of distribute people throughout the system evenly and make sure that there is not congestion on the trails. And by if we were to try to create some sort of pay parking system, I think there would be some conflicting goals. But we're open to those ideas. I think there are grant programs. We get state funding through the state of Utah, and there are other ways that we can try to get funding for our trail system that doesn't burden the taxpayer quite so much.
Sure. Okay. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us this morning. That's Basin Recreation Trails Manager Matt Wagner. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye now.